Welcome to the Northern Business Podcast, a regular discussion with people in the north of England who lead businesses, employ people, and have new ideas to help our economy grow. The Northern Business Podcast is produced by Recognition PR, and we serve scores of companies in different sectors across the country, some of which occasionally contribute to the podcast. We're kindly sponsored by Virtue Motors, one of the UK's automotive retailers with the most range of brands you could see. It's got a network of dealerships representing the world's most popular brands. I'm Graeme Robb, and in the studio today we have James Davis, who's the audit partner at Clive Owen LLP. Also joining us is Fraser Brown, founder and managing director of Motorvise, and also a person who owns a car dealership as well. So he's a very interesting character. He owns a business and he advises businesses. And down the line we have Georgiana Bristol, chief executive at the Jobs Foundation. Welcome all. First of all, it has been a momentous few weeks in the economy. This end of April saw the employers' NI implemented. It saw the new minimum wage implemented. And I was on one of these shadow MPC calls with you, Clive Owen and Co., Clive Owen LLP. And the vast majority of businesses who want a change were saying to the Bank of England, this week in May, cut interest rates. Now, how do you feel about that, everyone? Do you think interest rates should stay the same?
I'm absolutely in favour of a cut in our industry, in the motor industry. We have very expensive products, and as a result of that, most of them are funded. And the costs currently that the automotive retail sector are struggling with are one of the biggest ones, is interest costs. Second biggest thing that we're seeing in the motor trade at the moment is an employment freeze. Nobody's taking on staff because of both the interest rates, which are having an effect on costs. But in addition to that, the national insurance rise, and then the legislation that's coming down the line, pretty much everything coming together to kill business.
It is a storm, isn't it?
It is.
And but on motor industry, there's some specifics. I'll pick you up on that in a moment. Now, James, your firm represents lots of companies, as does mine. And the mood music I'm getting from my clients, and possibly you are getting from yours, let's hear, is that there is a sort of soggy acceptance that it's not good and we've got to work our way through. It's a little bit negative would be a very poor description, because it's a lot negative.
Yeah, and I think that's fair to say. And I think, you know, sort of as sort of touched on earlier, you know, access to finance for businesses, the right finance at the right time, is absolutely key to the running of businesses. So, you know, if that access was easier, a little bit more affordable, then that's just going to promote investment. It's going to promote growth within businesses. And at the moment, it just feels like the factors to sort of promote growth isn't really there, you know, like you mentioned with the various tax changes as well.
I know I can get accused by people watching and listening to this podcast of being a doom monger and talking down the economy. And I don't want to do that, because I think entrepreneurs really are the answer to the problems of the economy, not people who normally contemplate the navel. But do you find that your clients have got cards up their sleeve to play, or is it all about costs and productivity increases and profits being diminished?
I mean, there is some quiet optimism there. You know, absolutely, there is a lot of growth opportunities at the moment, particularly in the region. You know, at Clive Owen, we have sort of a very niche sort of grant part of our business, where we help a lot of businesses access to various grant funding. And there is a lot of grant funding there at the moment for, you know, whether it's fixed asset spend, whether it's for job creation. So there are opportunities there. I think a lot of it comes down to awareness. And, you know, a lot of the time the press isn't overly positive. So it's just knowing that those opportunities are actually there.
Now, Georgiana, you run a foundation which is UK-wide, and it's got a special Northern event coming up. So tell us about your foundation and what you're bringing to the party in the North.
I will do. So the Jobs Foundation, we're a relatively new charity. We launched in the summer of 23, set up to champion business as a force for good, specifically looking at the role business plays in terms of moving people from welfare into work. I would just say as a side point, we're very lucky to have over 1,000 business leaders as part of our business council. And just on the topic of tax, that just came up. We are hearing from, of course, SMEs across the country, the huge challenge of the national insurance contributions and what that's and the impact that's having, particularly in terms of employment, bringing new people into work, younger people into work, course, we have over, or sorry, I should say just under a million NEETs in this country, not in education, employment and training. So we're really very worried about that and recognizing the role that business plays as kind of the ultimate poverty busting mechanism that we have, and how important it is to support business in its work to get people into work and support them. In terms of the specific event, we are launching a series of regional councils across the country this year. And our first one is in the Northeast, at the Riverside Stadium in Middlesbrough next Friday, which we're very excited about. We've done lots of work and research in the Northeast, so it feels like the natural place to start.
And you've got an event coming up, and you've got quite a few good, well-known business leaders attending, people like Steve Gibson from Middlesbrough Football Club and Bull Call, and you've got people, I think, like Kieran Fothergill from Pickering's Lift, he's there. And there are other quite a few, but can anyone who's in business in the North, is it come along? Or can you be a one-man band, or do you have to employ hundreds of people?
No, we... If you employ people,
It's the Jobs Foundation. Yeah, you can't be a woman. Yeah,
exactly. You're creating jobs. We are here for you. So no. And I hope maybe in the socials that we share afterwards, we can share more information about that event. But no, we've got some great speakers. We've got Mads Howard from Sage, which is brilliant. Obviously, a big employer in the Northeast, and also Leanne Cahill, who is the Chancellor of Sunderland University. And very recently CEO of Bravissimo as well, and of course my co-founder Lord Elliott, who is going to be on the panel as well. So we're really excited and looking forward to it.
Well, on the panel we've got Fraser employs people. How many people do you employ?
Oh, about 60.
60. Oh, that's pretty impressive. I don't employ that many. I employ a lot of 11. Clive Owen, LLP, how many people work for you?
We're about 150 at the moment.
So there's quite a lot. Just in this small room, there's a lot of people in employment. Your enterprises, if you have an enterprise, I always say to fellow entrepreneurs that, you know, it can be construed as a noble thing. Yes, you're making money and there's a self-interest in it, but the outcome is also to spread wealth and to fund family life for hundreds of people. Just in this small room, we've got hundreds of people that are dependent on our enterprise.
I think about how much tax business pays as well. So if I look at how much we pay as a business, we probably pay into the teens of thousands per month in payroll taxes. We pay tens of thousands of pounds a year in corporation tax. We then pay well over £500,000 in VAT every year. And you start to add up all of these taxes, then there's my personal tax, that's for my wife. We end up paying hundreds of thousands of pounds in tax. My businesses alone is about £500,000 a year just in all of those taxes. And that's all because I chose to start two businesses. So without people, entrepreneurs, business people, all of this money goes back into the economy. It goes back into supporting education, the NHS. So business is a good thing, and profit is not something that we should be kind of negative about. So it's great to hear of foundations that are there to be pro-business, because there are so many things in this country right now that are anti-business, and it's a real battle just to survive at the moment.
Now, Georgiana, that was about your foundation. You talking about encouraging people to employ. Of course, there are obstacles. There are jobs that need doing, but when you take somebody on to do a job, you also take on an onerous legal liability for them in terms of money. And the government's just increased that. If you look at the payroll tax and the pension contribution, you're looking at a minimum of 18% of the cost of payroll of someone that's above £5,000. So that's quite a lot of money, £10,000, and you're nearly at £2,000 on top.
It's huge.
Are these barriers to job creation, do you think, fully understood by decision makers?
No, I don't. Just to be clear on that, no, I don't. I mean, I think that anything that can be done, whether it's on tax or regulation, or just as you say, kind of understanding about kind of businesses, business leaders across the country and the challenges they face. And, you know, as you all just touched on a minute ago, the huge responsibility that you have taking people on and training them, and particularly in the context of worklessness. You know, you may be bringing people on who've had little experience of work and need extra support and extra training, which is why at the Jobs Foundation, we think it's so important to give a national insurance contribution exemption to employers that take on people who are long-term out of work, which would seem to me very logical and very fair.
And that brings in tax can be two things. It can be used as an incentive and it can be used as a punitive measure.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, tax has to be levied somewhere because the government has to spend money. How much money the government spends is a debate, but it does have to spend money. But when it comes to employment taxes, it seems to me that tax can be used to disincentivize it. If the government wants to stop smoking, it taxes cigarettes. If it wants to stop drinking, it will increase the cost of alcohol, even taxing sugary drinks. But when it comes to employment, it's being taxed more.
Exactly. So if you tax employment more, you're going to get less of it. And actually, if you look at the statistics of late, in terms of the slowdown in employment and the slowdown that we're seeing, you know, without the gift of these tariffs that we're seeing and the fact that that's having a reduction on the cost of energy and therefore inflation is falling, without all of those things happening, the chances are we would not be getting the interest rate cuts that we're getting. So, you know, there are some silver linings in Trump's goings on at the moment in terms of the fact that we're now seeing an opportunity to reduce rates, which is one little gift for business over the coming months, we hope. So, you know, it's quite an interesting dynamic how the actual...
I think the Trump thing's interesting because I'm a free marketer and I don't like the idea of governments interfering with markets at all, and tariffs are an anathema to me. But the idea of drilling for oil and then pumping more oil and creating a market distortion that lowers the price of oil is the thing that really has distorted, helpfully, the energy price.
It is. And also the fact that they're predicting an overall slowdown in the economy because of these tariffs, which meant that all commodities seem to have dropped in value, which has helped with the inflation figures, which therefore helped the Bank of England to make decisions to reduce our interest rates. So I think it's an accidental benefit of the antics of these tariffs, which for our industry has been really negative.
What did you make of the trade deal that was struck between India and the UK? Because there were some incentives for workers, but there were also Indian-based workers who may work on license here, visa allowances. But there were also, and that's taken a lot of the coverage, but there were tariff reductions on British goods, cuts on whiskey, 40% over 10 years,
luxury gin, cars.
Yeah. Particularly cars, given that India owns our largest car producer, that seems to be a good outcome, do you think?
Yeah, definitely positive. I mean, at the end of the day, when you get tariffs of 20% put on for vehicles going into the US, those vehicles have got to find another market. You'll have seen very recently Jaguar Land Rover marketing heavily in their home market here, new TV adverts cropping up, and also no doubt products will get moved to divert it towards the Indian market because the tariffs have gone down to the lowest we've seen for a very long time. So, you know, it's a free market, and actually the biggest loser, I think, in this Trump's tariff thing going on is going to be the American consumer, because to build a car and build a car plant takes about 10 years. And to suddenly whack tariffs on that are going to have an impact in the space of 10 days, it doesn't allow them to build up supply chains. And ultimately, what business needs is stability. And with something like Trump in charge, you're not going to invest in that country because there is no stability.
Absolutely. Well, I don't entirely agree with you. I don't want to defend Trump because it's not the done thing, but there is something called creative instability, isn't there, where you put people on edge and you cause them to negotiate with you. Whether he's successful in that is another matter. And certainly the long term, as you say, invest in car plants, a long-term game, Matt?
I certainly think he's definitely got people to come to the table and negotiate, but ultimately that's what deal-making is, and he's a business person. So, you know, he's definitely incited people to negotiate with America, which is going to be positive for them. But on the flip side, you know, it's created instability. And certainly with a business like automotive and massive investments in automotive plants, you've got to have long-term stability. And even the fact that he's put tariffs on the import of parts that make up the cars so that the supply chain can be fed from outside of the US. And he's just gone backwards on that. So, you know, clearly there's a recognition there.
I think the interesting thing about the UK-India trade deal is it could be paving the way for the biggest trade deal, which would be the US-India trade deal, because they do want to destabilize China, and that would be a good way of doing it, because India and China are the ultimate manufacturing sector competitors, aren't they?
They are. And I think what we're about to see is not just a US-India trade deal, because these things, they're also going to see a US-UK trade deal. And the three things have to be on the same platform so that they've got kind of aligned rates of tariffs and things. So I think that this could end up being a really interesting three-way trade deal in the way that you just suggested.
Georgiana, I know you won't talk on this from the point of view of the Jobs Foundation, but do you have a personal point of view on this? You see a lot of the data?
I mean, I think a UK-US trade deal is very soon to emerge. So it will be fascinating to see what that looks like. I mean, I'd say in that sense, it's good news for the UK, both in terms of India and potentially with the US, and showing this country to be sort of light and nimble and being able to strike these deals. And I may do some more.
All right. Now, I'm going to close a little later with you, Georgiana, and with you, Fraser, about two different topics. I'll give you the chance to plug your event again, Georgiana. But first, there's one thing that you've been working on, James, which is a new regulation. Just want to spend 2 minutes talking about this because it is quite technical. It's called FRS 102. Yep. What is it?
So FRS 102 is the main accounting framework that businesses have to prepare their financial statements under. And it's been relatively unchanged for about 10 years. So the changes that are proposed to come in from 1st of January 2026, interestingly, can be early adopted now, actually, if it was seen to be beneficial to the business. These are some of the most significant changes that the accounting sort of world, for want of a better phrase, has seen in quite some time. So sort of the main changes are going to be around lease accounting and revenue accounting.
So give me a tangible example. I run a small business that leases a van for my staff to take video cameras in.
Yep.
The van doesn't go home, so it's not a server. It lives at the location. How would that van be treated today, and how would it be treated next year?
So currently, that van's going to be treated as an operating lease. So that asset, that van, effectively isn't going to be on your balance sheet as an asset. And you'll simply just have a rental charge go through your profit and loss account. Going forward, though, the treatment's going to be that you're actually going to bring that asset onto your balance sheet with a corresponding liability. So it's effectively going to be accounted for how current finance leases are accounted for. Now, I guess the particularly sort of interesting point with that is, in terms of the P&L, your overall profit's going to remain largely sort of unchanged, but the current treatment of rent costs are going to be replaced with depreciation and interest. So your EBITDA figure is going to go up significantly. So, you know, sort of businesses at the moment that are maybe looking to acquire, looking to sell, quite often those valuations that are used to sort of, you know, facilitate these acquisitions or disposals are based on EBITDA multiples. So it's absolutely vital that businesses are aware of this if they're going through those sort of processes at the moment.
So a silly example would be, that van costs my business £10,000 a year to lease, and I wanted to sell my business for £100,000 a year. I don't want to sell my business, by the way. At the moment, it would be £100,000, but it would notionally be a bit more profit if I wanted to sell it under the new regime, and people might give me a bit more money, and they shouldn't.
Exactly that. So potentially, so your business valuation at the moment, say £100,000, is going to be based on an EBITDA multiple with that cost in there currently. That EBITDA now is going to be a higher figure. So if you're applying the same multiple, your business value is going to be higher. So potential buyers could potentially be overpaying for exactly the same business if they weren't aware.
James, what's the purpose in this? Because it strikes me that treating a leased as a non-asset is rational. I don't own the van.
Mm-hmm.
I lease it. I pay for a service. The van is delivered. It's used. It's delivered back.
Yes.
Why? What's the purpose of this?
It's so the technical phrase is going to be a right of use asset, and that's what it's trying to reflect. It's trying to reflect your right to use that asset. And I guess the wider picture is it's to align with the international accounting standards, where this has been a thing for many years. So it's just trying to make sort of the information within the financial statements of all businesses sort of similar and comparable. Now, whether or not that's needed is a different question, because do we need to understand the financial statements of listed entities versus SMEs? I'm not so sure, but that's certainly the idea behind it.
It sounds like rather than simplify, it's making it more complicated. Fraser, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, bringing changes into accounting and into business is just more bureaucracy that's placed upon business. And right now, businesses are under the cosh for new employment laws that are coming in, additional minimum wage hikes, which seem relentless, national insurance, additional payroll taxes, and more bureaucracy on top of that. And very soon, we're going to have to make all of our accounting systems transparent on an ongoing basis to the revenue. It just sometimes feels like being in business when we contribute so much in tax and so many other things in terms of employment, it just feels like an incredible burden right now owning a business.
Well, look, the last subject I want to ask you about is the ZEV mandate. Now, this is something I've mentioned on this program, this podcast, many times over the last year. So we were ahead of the curve on it because Virtue Motors is one of our sponsors. So everyone knows how it would affect Virtue Motors. But just let's hear how the government have changed it and what effect do you think it could have, if any?
Well, ultimately, the ZEV mandate is mandating the amount of electric vehicles that can or cannot be registered inside the United Kingdom. So we're seeing kind of about a quarter of all vehicles this year have to be electric vehicles. Otherwise, the manufacturers get huge punitive fines.
28%. Nearly a third.
Nearly a third. And those numbers are growing every single year. So this is a government-controlled market. And you know, they have made it slightly easier for the manufacturers in the coming years, which is a positive thing. But let's be really clear, we are almost in a controlled market environment. I've said for many years that we need certainty, we need firm rules, we need to know where we're going as a business, certainly within the automotive sector. But right now, again, for all automotive manufacturers and dealerships, which is a huge percentage of our economy here in the UK, we're really feeling it because of this government-forced market that we've got at the moment, and consumers are paying for this out of their own pocket.
Well, let's drill down into the detail.
Yes.
There is a certain percentage of cars that have to be electric, 28%. One car above that, and the manufacturer gets fined £12,000, reduced from £15,000. So there's a lot of lashes, you know, public whipping, but just not as many.
Yeah, I mean, £12,000 or £15,000, if you go 10 cars over, that's a lot of money. But most manufacturers are talking about hundreds of thousands of units. Certainly, an average manufacturer in the UK might be somewhere around the 80 to 100,000 units in a year. So if you go 10% over, the fine is so punitive.
Virtue Motors have worked out that if you looked at the number of electric cars sold last year and applied it to this year, you'd be talking about 1.2 billion of fines. That's a lot of money coming out of the motor industry. And it's also encouraging rationing of petrol vehicles gradually. At the end of the year, as they miss the target, they're not releasing petrol vehicles. Notice that Tesla has seen a number of sales go down, electric vehicle manufacturer. The reasons might be different with Elon Musk and so on. But is Tesla able to sell quotas to the, because it only produces electric vehicles?
It does. So Tesla have, you know, no issue with the ZEV mandate. And there are other manufacturers like MG, they've got a huge electric vehicle content in their mix. And both of those manufacturers can then sell those credits to other manufacturers. So from a consumer and a business perspective looking to buy vehicles right now, you know, there's a big incentive on manufacturers to sell electric vehicles. But from a business and consumer perspective, over the coming years, you're going to find petrol and diesel cars become impossibly expensive. They will only be selling high-end petrol and diesel cars. And if you want to buy a more affordable car, it will have to be electric. So historically, we've seen electric vehicle prices significantly higher than petrol and diesel. But in light of the fact that we're going to ration these, the manufacturers are unlikely to be selling the cheaper cars as petrol and diesels. They're going to enrich in their mix.
Yeah.
And what we will see is a huge shift in price to ensure that the consumer is having to pay an obscenely high price for either vehicle.
You know, we're not seeing electric cars go down much more now. They're almost at the floor, would you say?
Well, incidentally, used electric vehicles are really good value for money right now, because a used electric vehicle at 2.5-3 years old is exactly the same price as a petrol and diesel car. But realistically, an electric car will cost you around 1 or 2 pence a mile to run, whereas a petrol car will cost you around 10 to 12 pence a mile to run, even more for big SUVs. So there is a huge benefit for consumers and businesses buying a 2 or 3 year old electric vehicle and paying the same price as petrol or diesel, but saving a fortune on the running costs.
And you also run a used car outlet.
Yes.
I'm sorry, Virtue Motors, of course, have used cars too. You only sell at the moment petrol, or do you sell electric as well?
Interestingly, 40% of what we sell is electric.
Right.
So we're based in Richmond in the north of England, and about 40% of the cars that we sell are EVs. And interestingly, a lot of them are Teslas, because they're such good value for money when you look at both the transaction price to buy it, but then the fact, you know, we've got the customers that buy cars off us save more in fuel than their entire monthly payment for buying that car. If you're doing 20,000 miles a year, you could save a couple hundred, £300 a month by buying an electric car, just in fuel savings, which offset all of your monthly payments.
I have a hybrid car, and I didn't need to charge up all the time, but I did take it down to the south of England last weekend for the bank holiday weekend, and I just stopped everywhere I could to get it charged. And do you know, I couldn't get it charged everywhere I wanted to stop. I stopped at various service stations, I stopped at hotels, and quite a lot of chargers didn't work. Quite a lot of chargers were full. There were too many people on them. And I fortunately didn't need the charge because I had petrol, so I let other people have it. But it was quite an interesting exercise. Well, it's not there yet, is it?
Well, most people don't use public chargers. So if you own an electric vehicle, you might use a public charger 2 or 3 times a year to go to the south of England. But I can guarantee that probably 90-95% of your journeys in a day, you'll never do more than 350 miles a day.
It's quite efficient scuttling to work and back. Georgiana, last point, reminders of the date of your business council meeting for the Jobs Foundation in the Northeast.
So our regional council launch is next Friday, the 16th of May. It's at the Riverside Stadium in Middlesbrough, where the title is Unlocking the Northeast Potential, Innovation, Infrastructure and Industry. And our regional chairman is Kieran Fothergill, who's very much brought the event together and has brought together many fantastic people to the audience next week. So we're excited and looking forward to it.
Georgiana Bristol, thank you very much. Also, thank you, James, and thank you, Fraser. That's it for this edition of Northern Business Podcast. If you want to take part and join our discussions, we're on every couple of weeks. Do get in touch via LinkedIn or via Recognition PR. Thanks to our podcast producer, Alex Dryden, and our technical operator, Robin Campbell. Join us next time on the Northern Business Podcast.